This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself to see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes and could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Merry Christmas, you spooky bitches. A little bird told us that there are still some of you that didn't quite get the chance to buy the spooky bitch merch that you wanted. So we've listened to your cries and we are going to be reopening the merch store on Boxing Day, and it will stay open right until the 1st of January. So if you missed it the first time round, you can get your t-shirts, your hoodies, your tote bags, the whole lot. And to make it even better, we are taking 20% off every single bit of it. So get yourself over to redhandedshop.com and don't miss out. I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to a very Christmassy Red-Handed. This is the last episode of 2019. We've done lots of things in 2019. We both quit our jobs. What a year. What a year. And we're going into 2020 full-time podcasters.
I know. Who would have thunk it? Not me, that's for sure.
Certainly not me.
No. You guys made it happen, though. We've had such a fucking good year. Like, we did first ever UK tour. We went to LA. Became full-time podcasters, we started selling merch, like, God, it's all just mad. It's completely mad.
Carnage madness.
This is, as Hannah said, going to be the last episode of 2019. You eagle-eyed calendar watchers may notice that that means that we will not be here next week. Don't worry, we will be back in January with an absolute banger. And for you who may not be able to go a week without listening to us, you can head over to Patreon, and anyone who is or becomes a $5 up Patreon, we are going to be doing a couple of like Car Chronicle episodes where we drove around Crete this summer and recorded ourselves talking about Cretan crimes, talking about Greek myths.
Getting it quite wrong.
And dating. So you can go listen to that.
Coming at some point before 2020.
Exactly. You will have them before 2020. They are there. They are coming. So yeah, you guys can enjoy that. And if you want an extra, like, even little bit more, you can go listen to Hannah guest hosted the Today in True Crime podcast.
Yeah, I did, didn't I?
And that came out yesterday. So if you're listening on the Thursday, it was the one that came out on Wednesday, the whatever. What day?
God, you've done good research. Well done. I had no idea.
So it will be the Today in True Crime episode that came out on Wednesday, the 19th of December. So go have a listen to Hannah being all cool over there. And enjoy that.
It was pretty cool. I just had to like ring the, I mean, you did the same thing, but we just had to like ring the studio in LA, and then two like nondescript American men were like, okay, so could you take that again, please? And I was like, what? You can't direct me. I am not to be directed. But I take direction incredibly well if anyone's interested.
So yeah, you can go listen to and be a judge of how well Hannah took direction. Enjoy.
But please don't tell it. My ego can't take it.
It's a lot. We've been too used to being just rogue and on our own in our own boxes all
yeah,
this time.
Literally.
But with that being said, I would say today is going to be a lot. So prepare yourselves.
I mean, as if this week wasn't already a lot for it. We are recording this on the morning of a brand new Tory Britain.
And it's Friday the 13th.
And it's a fucking full moon. It's a joke, mate.
Hannah is in full on meltdown. So I don't know if she's ready. I don't know if I'm ready. Are you guys ready? Because I don't think you're ready for this jelly. And by jelly, I mean the tragic murder of a small child. Because that's what's going to happen. Fucking hell, it's a lot.
On that note, it's Christmas time.
So let's get fucking festive. And it's the only way we know how to get festive. And it turns out that that means looking into the murder of a six-year-old girl that has been unsolved for decades. And it's also the case where so many true crime aficionados earn their stripes. You already know what it is, but let's just pretend we don't. Let's pretend we know nothing. I think that's important, actually, with this one, is that you know in Killing Eve, which I'm rewatching right now, Bill, they're like in the first season and they start this like crack team to try and find this assassin. And he's like, oh, but you're just assuming that they are all the same person. You don't actually have the evidence. So if we go into this case assuming that we know what happened, we're doing it wrong. So try and forget everything that you have already decided about JonBenet Ramsey.
I think that is the best advice that we can provide. Go into this with a fully open mind about what happened, who happened, what went down. I would say the best pairing for this episode, because Hannah and I spent it pretty much like a good few hours yesterday talking about this case. Sounded like we were fucking high, I have to say. we'll give you the transcript, have a listen, have a read. And the best pairing is probably a big fat joint, because it's the only case where the more you dig into it, the less it makes any sense, is all I'll say.
Also, not condoning drug use on the airwaves.
No, maybe we should leave that out.
A big fat something that we won't mention. I don't even fucking smoke weed, man. Let's transport ourselves with our clear minds to just before midnight on Christmas night, 1996, on 15th Street in Boulder, Colorado. A woman heard a scream. And she was sure of two things. Firstly, that the scream was coming from the house across the road. It was a big old faux Tudor mansion, you know exactly what I mean. And it belonged to the Ramsey family. The second thing our anonymous neighbour was sure of was that the scream was that of a small child, and she thought it was most probably a little girl. After the scream, the neighbour woke her husband, and they both heard a loud crash that sounded like metal hitting concrete. The neighbour decided not to call 911 because she knew that the Ramseys would be home and was sure that they were more than capable of dealing with the situation on their own. And no one likes a nosy neighbour.
As we all know, the Ramseys had a little girl. Her name was JonBenet. And on Boxing Day, she would be found dead in her own home. JonBenet's parents had married each other in 1980. John Ramsey was a successful businessman. His company was called Access Graphics. And in 1996, it was valued at $1 billion. That's right, 1 billion with a B. Fucking hell, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they had so much money that the family had not only a 30-foot yacht, but two private planes. Why do you need two? There's only four of them.
Exactly. Like, does the plane need a friend to hang out with? Do they get lonely? Like, is that... It's like when people can only get
maybe
two
guinea
pigs.
Maybe they're like guinea pigs, where you have to have two of them.
And I think, like, obviously, $1 billion, that's an astonishing amount of money. And I think that Bill Gates might be the exception here, but I'm not sure that anybody builds a company that is worth that much by being a nice guy. Surely.
Like Warren Buffett, he's a very nice man, I think. There's also a couple of others, maybe politically charged, and then people will come for us if we name them. But I did actually read some interesting stuff about this, that a lot of research has been done. And actually they found that there is like a direct link between niceness, quote unquote, and financial ruin.
What, because you're just so nice and you give all your money away?
I think because it's you're so more nice. Because apparently, you know, like the big five personality traits?
Yes, yeah.
One of them is agreeableness. And agreeableness and financial ruin is apparently linked to the level that people with higher levels of openness up to 50% more likely to declare bankruptcy or to default on payments and things. Isn't that interesting?
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah.
I'm a really open person. I need to keep a hold on my fucking financials.
No, it's, agreeable, not the open.
Oh, yeah, I'm not that. I think you've probably got to shit on some people on your way up to the top. And according to the people who worked for John Ramsey, that is exactly what he was like. Access Graphics was, quote, an evil empire. That's a direct quote from an employee. Hostile takeovers and a hostile work environment were pretty run-of-the-mill.
Yeah, I mean, you have that whole thing of like, if the CEO is a psychopath, the business is psychopathic. And not saying John Ramsey was a psychopath, but somebody who works for you calling the business an evil empire
doesn't
paint you as much less than like Darth Vader, does it?
That's exactly what I thought, fucking Star Wars motherfucker.
In 1980, John married Patsy, who was a whole 14 years younger than he was. When they got married, John was 37 and Patsy was just 23. Patsy was also a former Miss West Virginia. John had 3 children from a previous marriage, and soon after they got married, Patsy and John had 2 additional children of their own. Burke, who in 1996 was 9, and JonBenet, who was 6. JonBenet was in the pageant system just like her mum, and the pair even looked very alike, and they sang together all the time.
There's a really weird thing in one of the books that I read this week where apparently one of the songs that was played at JonBenet's funeral service was a song from Gypsy, which is a musical in which a mother has 2 daughters and one of them goes on to be like a burlesque performer and the other one goes on to be like an incredibly successful vaudeville actress. It's like a very odd choice to have at your 6-year-old daughter's funeral.
I don't understand so much about Patsy Ramsey.
I don't think she's dumb, though. Like, I think a lot of people are just like, she's a trophy wife, blah, 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 blah. She had a degree in journalism, no less. I don't think she was a doormat.
No, I think it was more just like, because she's, and we obviously talk about this later, but like, she's from, you know, she's like from that pageantry world. I think she's probably just like quite a theatrical person, like that song and everything. Like, I don't know. I have feelings about the whole pageant situation.
I have many feelings. I do know a bit more about drag queen pageants than I do about kid ones. But I imagine the basic principle is the same. And my like fully grown woman pageant knowledge is almost exclusively linked to Drop Dead Gorgeous and Dumplin'. But as I understand it, this is what happens. You dress up in several different kind of outfits and then you walk around and you answer questions and then you perform your talent. Not necessarily in that order, but that's, as I understand it, what happens for children and women and drag queens alike. That is quite a lot to ask of a 6-year-old. But JonBenet was very good at it. She won a lot. And later on, people, namely her mother, would claim that JonBenet's involvement in pageants was just a bit of fun and it only took up the occasional Sunday. Patsy makes quite a big deal about JonBenet only entering 9 pageants. She was 6. 9 is quite a lot, I think. And presumably she wasn't doing baby pageants where she just gets wheeled around in a pram.
Because even if she's been doing them just from, like, say, the age of 4, that's a lot of pageants to have done in 2 years or whatever.
Prep for a pageant is serious business. And there is video footage of JonBenet at pageants in all sorts of different things, from like a Copacabana-esque feather contraption to like a cowgirl outfit. Like, that's expensive. That's money. And also, to get 6-year-old JonBenet's talent to an adequate standard, that's at least an hour of practice every day. Like, that's what you get told when you learn a musical instrument. That's the fucking minimum. And if she's winning, she's good. Like, she's not just, like, getting up and, like, murdering fucking Amazing Grace on the violin. She's winning. So, obviously, it's a lot of work.
Patsy is like a terrifying sequined tiger mum. She is like, this is what's happening. Get on board. Is how I envision it happening.
Oh, completely.
Have you ever watched Toddlers and Tiaras?
Oh, have I? Yes, I have. I am obsessed.
I also watched a great show called Blinging Up Baby.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a thing. It's a thing. This is a thing that's happening. It's absolutely terrifying.
And I just feel like we don't have pageantry here basically at all. Like, the only thing I can think of is the Rose of Tralee, which is like an Irish competition. That's not even, doesn't really happen here. And that is televised and that is a big deal. But it's not like there's a bajillion of them. And it's not like, oh, what's your hobby? Oh, I do pageants.
It's just, it's weird. I don't know. Maybe somebody listening used to do pageants as a kid and they can tell us all about it on the Facebook group. Do
like,
it. I
entered
know.
A lot of competitions as a kid, but like they were never to do with me wearing a feather boa.
No, I did a taekwondo and I got as far as like an orange belt and I was like, no more. I'm done. I'm bored of this. I don't know. I was never a very graceful child, though. I don't think I would have been a successful pageanteer. That's for sure.
I sort of did. I just feel like I did the sort of talent segment of being a pageant child, but I didn't do the fucking bikini bit, you know?
No. I think that's the bit best of all we did. I wouldn't even let my mum brush my hair, so she just cut it all off. I spent the first like 6 years of my life looking like a little boy. I even used to brush my hair into a little side part so I actually looked like a boy. So Patsy, John, Burke and JonBenet were a popular little family unit. They attended parties at their neighbours' houses and they very often threw their own. And they were excellent hosts and they had actually hosted one of their little soirees for the neighbourhood just 3 days before Christmas. Things had gone a little bit awry and the police actually ended up being called to the house. But the whole thing was ironed out as a drunken misunderstanding, or perhaps even more like a drunken prank. And no further action was taken.
These are adults. Why are you prank calling fucking 911 at your Christmas party? What the fuck is wrong with you?
They're rich people. They're rich, yeah. Drunk people. Let's see how quickly we can get those policemen out here. Bets. I'll put a private plane on it. Like, who knows, yeah, what rich people do, man?
I plan on finding out.
Yeah. But at 5:52 a.m. on Boxing Day 1996, another 911 call came from the Ramsey house. But this time, it was no joke at all. Panicked Patsy Ramsey told the dispatcher, "We have a kidnapping. There's a note left, and our daughter is gone." The 911 operator, whose name was Kim Archuleta, listened as Patsy Ramsey described her daughter as being 6 years old and blonde. When Patsy was assured that the police were on their way, she hung up the phone. Or at least she thought that she had. Actually, there are about 6 seconds on the end of the 911 call where Kim could hear voices in the background. Voices who didn't think that they were being listened to.
And Kim, years later, would claim that she had stayed on the line because she felt like something wasn't right. As a 911 operator, I expect that's a feeling she had quite a lot.
I'm also like, if you call 999 or 911 or whatever, don't they usually not let you put the phone down until you can see the emergency services? Like, until they're in your line of sight?
I think it depends. But you would think if your daughter had just been kidnapped, you'd kind of want to stay on the phone, surely. I don't know. I've never been in that situation. But it doesn't seem like... I think you'd want to stay connected with the help that was coming.
It doesn't
seem
like you'd just be like, hey, reported, job done, tick, I'll put the phone down and go back to something else. It does seem weird that Patsy tries to put the phone down.
And Kim also claimed that she heard Patsy say, quote, "We've called the police, now what?" Kim was never interviewed by the police in relation to the death of JonBenet Ramsey, so her testimony was never heard anywhere. Arguably the most famous documentary on this case is the one produced by CBS in 2016. It's called The Case of JonBenet Ramsey. And essentially what happens is a team of crime experts who are not offensive looking, they're like, fine looking enough to be on TV, I think seems to be like the only criteria for being on that team. And basically these experts get together and they solve the mystery of who killed JonBenet Ramsey. And this documentary is responsible for a lot of people having a quite stark opinion on what happened to little JonBenet. And I used to be one of them, but I've got to say, now I'm not so sure. And here is one of the many reasons why I'm not so sure. In the CBS documentary, they take the 911 call and run magical noise reduction on it. And then they claim that they can hear three distinct voices. Honestly, it's so funny. The first time I watched that documentary, I knew nothing about sound. I knew nothing about how audio worked. But when they're running this noise reduction, they're all sitting there with their headphones on. And it's literally like on CSI when they're like, enhance, enhance. It's exactly like that. And then they turn this little knob on the soundboard. And I'm like, that's doing fuck all to do with noise reduction. That's literally just like, but they make such a big deal putting it in the shot. This like magical thing that we can't understand as like just TV watchers.
Maybe it's because it's too boring to show them like select the section of silence and then go to noise reduction in Audacity and remove it and then listen back
I'm
to
sure
it.
I'm sure they weren't using
just
Audacity.
For effect, just turn this knob and everybody looks so surprised ridiculous. By what has already been done.
So after they've run this magical fucking pretend noise reduction, the CBS team claim that they can hear John Ramsey saying, "We're not talking to you." Patsy Ramsey saying, "What did you do? Help me, Jesus." And then they claim that they can hear little Burke saying, "What did you find?" Go and watch it and make your own mind up. But I cannot hear a single fucking word of that. I can't hear any of it, even when they impose the Mandela effect on it and they give you the writing underneath of what you're meant to be hearing. I literally could not hear anything.
It's very much like about suggestibility. They're just like putting the captions on underneath. They're telling you what you're hearing. And of course, therefore, you hear it when you listen to these muffled voices. The only thing I can remotely hear is I can believe I can hear Patsy saying, "Help me, Jesus." But like her kid has just been disappeared. Yeah. So like, that's not the weirdest thing. And she says that quite a lot.
I'm just not convinced that they can hear three distinct voices, and I'm not convinced they can
No. I don't think you can hear three distinct voices, and I don't think you can really pick up on the tone of voice, which is what the CBS documentary also makes a big deal about.
So then after they've decided that's what they've heard on the call, Scotland Yard-trained Laura Richards and her team of criminology masterminds use this piece of evidence, which in my opinion is a pretty flimsy piece of evidence, to conclude that at the time the 911 call was made, all three remaining Ramseys, so that's Patsy, John and Burke, were all awake.
But Patsy would tell a very different story to police officers when they arrived at her house at 5:59 a.m. She opened the door wearing the same clothes that she had worn to the party that they had attended the night before. In between the 911 call and the officers arriving, Patsy also called two friends and the family's pastor, all of whom made their way to the Ramsey mansion as soon as they could.
I think they only hang out with married couples. So they'll say like, oh, we called the Whites or we called the like Glynns or whatever. So I think it's two sets of people. It's like a couple that show. So there's five people that show up at the house.
Why is my question. You've called 911. You've reported your daughter missing. Why in the early hours of Boxing Day morning do you call your family, friends and the family pastor and tell them to come over? I don't understand why you would want those people to be necessarily around you in that time. I don't get it. But again, I haven't been in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you just sort of want the support. They think the house, well, whether they think this or not, they think that nothing's going on in the house. So they would be like, well, why would it be a crime scene? Because she's gone, arguably.
Well, if she is gone and she's not in the house, spoilers, it's still a crime scene.
True,
because she was
true.
Abducted from the house. I mean, again, like we know that they're not, well, we don't know that they're not thinking about it like that. We don't know what the fuck they're thinking, but this is what they do. Anyway, that's the best I can give you. This is what they do. Patsy told the officers that the night before, the whole family had attended a party at one of those friends' houses. So at one of the friends' houses that is now currently at the Ramsey house. She told them that they had then left and driven home. And as they did, that Jean Benet had fallen asleep in the car. She said that when they then got home, John Ramsey had carried Jean Benet upstairs and put her to bed. Then they had all gone to sleep and that no one had woken up in the night. Patsy had then got up before dawn because she needed to get everybody ready for a flight that the family were taking to Michigan. Because the Ramseys had a holiday home in Michigan overlooking a lake and they planned to see in the new year together there. Now, the first time that Patsy told this story, she said that she had gone into Jean Benet's room and realized that she was gone. But the second time she told it, she said that she had gone downstairs to make coffee and at that point found a 3-page handwritten ransom note on the stairs. After seeing it, reading it, she had then gone to check Jean Benet's room and realised that her 6-year-old daughter was missing.
So she either finds that she's gone first or she finds the note first. She tells both versions of that story. And like, obviously, she's distressed. It's pretty important detail, though.
It is an important detail. And the fact that she's confused around that particular very binary thing. Like, it's either one or the other. Like, did you find the ransom note first or not? And I feel like it's quite a memorable thing. It's not like the kind of thing that we normally say where it's like, poor eyewitness testimony. Did they see this thing here? Did they see, like, did you find the ransom note and rush into Jean Benet's room in a panic? Or did you casually go in there to check on your sleeping daughter? Like, it's a big thing to misremember.
But one thing that Patsy is sure of, and this remains in both of the stories that she told, Patsy claimed that her son Burke was sound asleep. And when officers arrived at the house, they conducted a superficial search, but nobody thought to look in the basement. And this is a proper rich person basement. It's got doors and lights and corridors and everything, but no officer thought to look, at least not at first. The mates that Patsy had called and the pastor were allowed to wander around the house freely. No part of the house was secured by law enforcement as a crime scene, and we will never know what evidence was lost that morning. At 8:10, Detective Linda Arndt showed up to the already ruined crime scene. When she arrived, Patsy was crying in an armchair, or rather she was making crying noises, and no actual tears were falling. And you look out for that in any footage you see of Patsy. She does that quite a lot, particularly at press conferences. And John Ramsey was pacing. When children disappear, there is roughly a 12-to-1 chance that the parents are involved. But despite those odds, not a single officer separated the Ramseys for questioning to see if their stories correlated. Instead, they focused on bonding with the Ramseys. The Ramseys refused to give interviews to the police, claiming that they were too distraught and medicated. Despite that, the officers managed to glean that all of the doors were locked when the Ramseys woke up, and the only sign of forced entry was a few pry marks on the kitchen door. They weren't obvious, they just looked newer than the rest of the marks on the door. There's no way of knowing whether it actually happened that morning or not.
And could we say that this whole sort of... because it's clear to say that that morning, it's quite piss poor police management of a crime scene, how they're managing this. I think, is it because you said that Boulder, Colorado had like a ridiculously low murder rate?
Yeah, what
so
a year.
They're just not experienced.
Yeah, but like, come on. You may not have the experience, but like, you will have had training in how to sort out this situation.
Absolutely not. I'm just trying to give like, play devil's advocate. So if we say A, they absolutely were not super experienced in terms of homicides, given that they were dealing with roughly one a year. Secondly, also, I think, is it in the CBS documentary that they say, also, generally speaking, around Christmas time, you're not going to have the best police officers slash detectives working the beat. What, so maybe they didn't have the very best people come to deal with this scene originally. Maybe that's unfair. I don't know. I think it was in the CBS documentary that they say that as a potential reason for why it was so poorly handled. I don't know. But a walkthrough of the exterior of the house that the police did do revealed that there was a broken window leading to one of the many basement rooms. John Ramsey claimed that it was actually him that had broken this window when he had locked himself out of the house the summer before. And he simply said that he had never got round to fixing it. Many people, due to another documentary, think that this broken window was the entry point for an intruder, which, of course, it totally could be. But the crime scene footage shows an unbroken cobweb in the corner of that window, so of the broken window. And it's a bloody small window. It's really hard to believe that an adult would have been able to squeeze their way through that window and leave that cobweb completely undamaged. It doesn't make any sense. And in the CBS documentary, they must have spent a fucking shitload on that because they like rebuild the Ramsey house.
Oh, yeah. Fucking loads of money in that documentary. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They like recreate the window. They recreate the cobweb, everything. And then Laura Richards recreates the kind of theory that somebody climbs through this window. What we do learn is that she can't do it without disturbing the cobweb. And what we also learn is that Laura Richards is fucking strong as fuck.
Who is your trainer, Laura?
She just crawls out of it.
Like, she lifts herself up. Like, you know how like gymnasts just like can lift themselves? She literally puts her hands out the window and then she pulls herself up slowly and controlled until her waist is out of the window, just using her arms. Yep. It's madness.
It is madness. And she's a tall lady. She's like not, you know, petite lady. She's like a tall lady. And she just pulls herself like really elegantly out of that window. I was like, what the fuck? I don't know. It's crazy. But also like, if Laura Richards can't do it as elegantly as she did it without disrupting that cobweb, I think we can pretty much say that it probably wasn't the entry point for any kind of intruder.
And what I find odd, so obviously the Ramseys story at this point is they're like, someone's broken into our house and they've taken our daughter. Why then, at the only entry point, is John saying, oh no, I actually broke that window, that was me. The only way I can sort of get around that is maybe, so he obviously broke the window to let himself into the house. So in theory, the intruder puts their hand through the thing and then opens the window from the inside and gets in that way, I suppose. But I just don't know why. I mean, obviously, if he's telling the truth, then he's got nothing to hide. And why wouldn't you be like, oh, I actually did break that, but it does mean they could have got in without using the door. It just seems odd.
Is there glass? Because if he broke it the summer before, I mean, he didn't get around to fixing it, but presumably you didn't just leave a load of smashed glass lying around inside the basement. So maybe it didn't look like a fresh
good
smashing,
point, yeah.
If you see what I mean. So they had to be like, oh, that window was already broken, but it does mean that somebody could have seen that and used it to get into the house. But if we like, fine, leave aside the cobweb, maybe this person was like a tiny little eel of a person that crept through without and didn't want to, you know, destroy this poor spider's buffet in the corner. Who knows? The thing we can say is that there were no footprints in the snow. So how could somebody have walked around the house to get to that broken window that led into the basement? There are no footprints in the snow that lead there. So again, even if you can accept that somebody came in that way, it doesn't look possible that somebody walked around to that window that night. So that's a pretty big for that being the entry point. So I think Hannah and I, having gone through this research, having discussed it, there's not 100% of things that we're sure on. But if there is one thing we're pretty certain of, it's that all of the proverbial calls are coming from inside the house. This is like a locked room mystery. There's four people in this house. One of them dies. There's no real other opportunities for other people to get in and out of the house. So it kind of feels like it was one of them. Yeah.
It's Cluedo.
Yeah, it's Cluedo.
This is a paid advertisement for BetterHelp. Some people love summer. School's out, sun is shining, and adventure's the name of the game. But there is the other side of the season. Sweaty commutes, life admin, the social pressure of feeling like you have to make the most of the longer days. Summer becomes less about thriving and more about surviving. And I am in that second camp. If you're a summer stressor too, then therapy is a great way to find balance. With over 30,000 therapists worldwide, BetterHelp is one of the leading online therapy platforms, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Therapy can help people better understand their needs, feel more confident setting boundaries, and create a version of summer that actually feels good. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/redhanded. That's betterhelp.com/redhanded.
My dad has lived a pretty crazy and interesting life. But honestly, you wouldn't know it. He can be pretty private. Sometimes all it takes, though, is a memory, and he's off. So this Father's Day, I'm getting him an Aura frame. It's a digital photo frame that you can preload with unlimited photos. So you can tee up some of his best stories and make sure those memories don't just exist in his head. And Aura frames come with free unlimited storage, and you can preload as many photos and videos as you want before it even ships. So by the time he opens it on Father's Day, it's already chock full of memories. And if you download the free Aura app, you can share new photos and videos anytime. Named number one by Wirecutter, you can save now by visiting auraframes.com. For a limited time, listeners can get $35 off their best-selling Carver Matt frame with code REDHANDED. That's auraframes.com, promo code REDHANDED. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Taking the plunge with a new idea is always daunting. When we started Red-Handed, I remember worrying, what if no one listens to us? But despite the fears and the what-ifs, it was all worth it. And it helped having a partner like Shopify on our side to help. Shopify is the e-commerce platform supporting household names like Heinz and Mattel, as well as brands just getting started. It's like having a built-in business partner, one that helps you manage your marketing, data analytics, and retail processes all seamlessly in one place. The iconic Shop Pay button is converting clicks to sales for millions of businesses worldwide, and yours could be next. It's time to turn those what-ifs into... with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/redhanded. Go to shopify.com/redhanded. That's shopify.com/redhanded.
And although the police did a shit job of the rest of the crime scene, they did manage to capture video footage of the Ramsey house that day. And in one of the shots, a black torch or flashlight is clearly visible on the kitchen counter. But this was dismissed by the crime scene unit and not collected as evidence.
The 3-page handwritten ransom note, which we will get into in great detail later, don't panic, instructed John Ramsey to withdraw $118,000 from the bank and wait for a call between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. The Ramseys, the Ramseys mates, the Ramseys pastor, and the Boulder Police Department all waited patiently for this call. It never came. Detective Linda Arndt then suggested that John and his friends search the house starting from the top and working their way down. John ignored this instruction and headed straight for the labyrinth basement. He went into a particularly small basement room and screamed as he saw a white blanket on the floor. He picked up this white blanket and the little figure that was wrapped up inside it. Some say that he started to scream before he'd even turned on the light, so how could he possibly have known that a blanket on the floor in a dark room contained the corpse of his daughter? But he was right. It was JonBenet, and she had been lying almost exactly under the spot where her mother had been sitting and making crying noises for hours. JonBenet had duct tape over her mouth. A white cord was wrapped around her right wrist over her pyjama top. The other end of the cord was loose, as if it had once been tied around her left wrist. Her hands were over her head, not as one might expect behind her back. And there were also, her right hand was tied with a slip knot. So if she wanted to get it off her hand, she would have been able to do it incredibly easily. There was also a white cord around her neck that had been tightened by a small piece of wood to make a sort of makeshift garrote. And this piece of wood would later be identified as having been broken off one of Patsy's paintbrushes. The white cord would later be found to be an exact match for one that was on sale at an army shop right around the corner from John's office at Access Graphics. It's not that difficult to assume, I think, therefore, that everything found on JonBenet's body was already in the Ramsay mansion.
And not to go on about police deficiencies in the handling of this crime scene, but also kind of yes, because that's why we're here. But why does the detective tell John Ramsay to search the house? The statistics are so clear when a child goes missing or something happens that the parents cannot be ruled out as suspects. They're in the fucking house and she lets them search the crime scene, potentially disposing of evidence, fucking with shit. Even if they were innocent, why are they allowed to search the fucking house? It's so bizarre.
You can either take two lines of thought on it. You can either be like, oh, they just wanted to keep him busy so they could speak to Patsy without him being there, possibly. Or they showed up to the Ramsay house that day with the assumption that the Ramsays couldn't possibly be involved. And therefore, they're allowed to do what they want because their daughter's missing and they're distraught. It's either or.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the latter. If you want to keep him busy, give him a fucking Rubik's Cube or something. I don't know. Lock him in a corner. Like, don't give him the most destructive task, which is trampling.
He's also allowed to leave the house for over an hour and he goes on his own.
This is what I mean. There are so many holes. The reason we will never have a conclusive answer to this story without a shadow of a doubt is because I believe of the fuck-uppery that happens in the first few hours when the police arrive at the scene. Like, it's unbelievable. And also so suspect that he goes straight to the basement. I think he was like, fucking, we called the police. We've set up her body downstairs. Obviously, I'm giving away what I think happened. The police don't even go check the basement. He's like, for fuck's sake. Okay, I'm just going to go do it. Oh, she's here. I found her. Sob, sob, sob. So after he found her body, John ripped the duct tape from his daughter's mouth. Again, he's just allowed to fucking handle this body. That is the main piece of evidence now, is JonBenet's corpse. Drips the duct tape off her mouth. And then he picks her up, carries her out of the basement, and lays her on the living room floor for all of those assembled to see. It screams to me of, like, almost exhibiting it. It's like, here you go. I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, and why are you lying her on the floor unless you know she's already dead?
Yeah. Why doesn't he immediately start, like, trying to resuscitate her or doing something in the basement? Picks her up and carries her to the living room and just lays her on the floor. I mean, obviously we weren't there, so we can't tell exactly how this went down. But the fact that he was A, allowed to, and the fact that he does these things just seems very odd. Detective Linda Arndt gave the following description of the condition of JonBenet. Quote, the girl's lips were blue. She had rigor mortis. She was not breathing. Her body was cool to the touch. There was a red circular mark in the front of her neck, about the size of a quarter, at the base of her throat. She had an odour of decay to her, and she had dried mucus from one of her nostrils. So it was quite clear to the trained eye that JonBenet had been dead for quite some time. Patsy, with her distinctly untrained eye, collapsed on top of her daughter, declaring, Jesus, you raised Lazarus from the dead, raise my baby. Again, they're allowed to just, like, touch the body again. Then everyone in the house prayed together over little JonBenet's blanket-clad body, further disturbing all of the evidence. Now, we're unsure why the police's first priority was communion with God and not preservation of the site of a homicide. But then again, we've never been to Colorado.
At what stage in a murder investigation is the police detective like, okay, let's just have a little pray. and then we'll figure it out.
I really think it ties into what you said. I think they went there, they arrived there, they see a hysterical Patsy, a pacing John. I think they immediately read the situation. They profiled this rich couple as not having had anything to do with their daughter's murder. They just immediately decided that. Then when they find the body, I think they just are like, this poor, poor family. We better let them do what they need to grieve because this horrible tragedy has happened to them. And the investigation, unbelievably, came second to that. I really feel like that's what I have to hope it is. Because if it's not that, it's a massive fucking conspiracy of a cover-up right from the start.
JonBenet's body was carried out of her home at 10:45 p.m. that evening in a body bag. And John, Patsy and little Burke never returned to their home. They stayed with friends for a really long time before they moved somewhere else. And so the question that has plagued true crime fans for the past 25 years was formed. Who killed JonBenet Ramsey? Was it an intruder or something a bit more sinister? Initially, the press was sympathetic towards the Ramsey family and the whole affair was painted as a tragedy. But that narrative didn't last very long. Assistant District Attorney for Boulder Bill Wise was the very first bright spark to realise that kidnapping victims don't usually show up in their own homes. Suspicion around the family grew, and this was not helped by their refusal to be interviewed under oath and on video by police. And it was double not helped by their decision to hire a PR team and many top-notch defence lawyers. Their superstar dream team included big dog attorney Hal Haddon, who had managed former Senator Gary Hart's political campaigns. Their spokesperson was Patrick Courton, who they flew in all the way from DC, and he made himself famous by his defence of Oliver North. And they also had a retired FBI agent in their employ. So John argued that he assembled this team because he wanted the best minds in the country on the case. But to everyone else, it looked like he was trying to wage a spin war.
The Ramseys appeared on CNN before they allowed themselves to be interviewed on video by the police, which, if you haven't done anything wrong, seems like an odd move to make. And in the CNN interview, John and Patsy talk about finding who was responsible for JonBenet's death and why they did it. Surely speaking to the police would speed up that process more than just going on CNN.
But also, if they did do it, they did get away with it, so it did work. Like, they just are so obsessed with the public perception of them that that's the thing that is the priority rather than talking to the police.
Yeah, I agree. And they did get away with it, but not successfully enough that, you know, 25 years later that people are still like, they fucking did it. Like, they go and they act so suspiciously in these interviews. And I know we've spoken about this time and time again, that you can't judge how somebody behaves immediately after a tragedy because, like, people respond to grief and things like that in a very different way. That is absolutely true. But there are, like, odd things that they do. Like, watch that documentary, watch the CNN interview. Patsy does a lot of, like, shaking her head the wrong way. And she is completely doped up. Like, you can tell she's on a lot of medication. And the CBS documentary does point this out, so I can't take credit for it. But I do think it's interesting that they say, we want to find who did this to JonBenet, but we're not angry. We just want to know why. What? If somebody had done this, or I was pretending that somebody had done this, somebody had broken into my house and murdered my six-year-old daughter, angry would be a pretty key word in how I was feeling. I'm not angry, I want to know why.
And it's about 2 weeks after she dies they do the CNN interview.
And in the CBS documentary, they make an important point about this. When you say, I'm not angry, I want to know why, does that not sound like a parent talking to a child who's done something wrong?
Yeah.
Enter Burke Ramsey. It's a very weird phraseology, and words matter. When they were on the CNN interview, they also announced that they would offer a $100,000 reward for anyone with information, $50,000 of which they had donated themselves. Which again, of course, this is a usual thing that happens, but it does seem odd in this case because they were being the most obstructive force in this case. How can you ask the public for information when you yourself are refusing to give any? It's strange. And despite their selective interview choices, as the investigation into the death of JonBenet raged on, the press stuck to the Ramseys and their friends like glue. One journalist even joined the same church as the Ramseys just to get a closer look. He claimed that he had never seen anyone pray for their soul like Patsy Ramsey prayed for hers. Public opinion on the Ramseys was somewhat split. Some saw them as good, God-fearing people who had been incredibly unlucky. Others thought them entering their six-year-old child into beauty pageants and dressing her up like a woman, dyeing her hair, putting makeup on her, was perverse. I do think the hair dyeing is quite extreme.
Yeah, but like when I was however old, six or seven, I went to a Spice Girls concert, dyed my hair black for that.
Six? You dyed your hair at six?
I think I was six or seven, yeah.
Oh, wow. But I don't know, is it because like dyeing your hair black, you can do it with like packet colour, but like dyeing your hair blonde from being darker, that's bleach.
Yeah, true, very true.
But Patsy and John had moved to Boulder from Atlanta, Georgia. And apparently, pageanting is a much bigger deal in Georgia. And when they had like moved themselves, many Boulderites just saw it as not particularly Colorado appropriate. So I think there is some cultural issue here.
Oh, totally. I think like I can't remember in which bit of the many clickable links there will be below, but there I read an interview with like a sort of Boulder native, and they're sort of saying that, I'm not going to phrase this very well, but they sort of said people who live in Boulder have ideas about themselves and pageantry doesn't fit into those ideas. You're right, it's a cultural difference. It's just not as prevalent as it would have been in Atlanta.
When I watch like Toddlers and Tiaras and stuff like that, I think it's more of like a southern thing. Mm. And then when they moved out of there, it was kind of maybe looked upon as being quite a strange thing to do. But nonetheless, clouds of suspicion had started to gather over the Ramsey family.
FBI profiler John Douglas interviewed the Ramseys and said, quote, if they're responsible for the killing, they are tremendous liars. And he said that after he'd spoken to them for a couple of hours. He claimed that he didn't believe, quote, in his heart, that they were responsible for JonBenet's death. You are an FBI profiler. Should you not be using a little bit more than your heart here? And also, well, not a lesson, but this has been really hammered home this week. One man's FBI profiler is another man's FBI bullshit artist. You can find an expert to say literally whatever you want. John Douglas is interesting because he is the inspiration for both Silence of the Lambs and Mindhunter. And he had just written his fourth book and he had to stop off in Boulder to promote it. And this is obviously incredibly cynical of me, but I think he just sort of wanted to cause a stir. Like, John Douglas seems very switched on and very smart. And in making a comment on the Ramsey case that goes against what everyone else thinks, that's going to get you in the papers. John Douglas didn't help them that much. The Ramseys were certainly under suspicion and the police had absolutely nothing to go on. But the Ramseys did give them handwriting samples and hair samples and stuff like that. But they did consistently refuse to be interviewed under oath and on video. The police were stumped. Months of investigation revealed no smoking gun in the 700 crime scene photos and the 10,000 pages of investigative material and the 850 tips from the public. There was nothing. The Ramseys fantasy football legal team, pitted against the local Colorado authorities, was a David and Goliath match, and the Ramseys knew it.
The autopsy of JonBenet's body was released in three stages, but we've collated all of it here and hope to give you a clear overview. But there are a lot of differing opinions with this. All of the direct quotes we have from the autopsy are from a book called Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey? And the conclusions that you're about to hear are from the co-author of that book, whose name is Dr. Cyril Wecht. Now, they are not everyone's conclusions, and this case has really made us question who to trust. It seems that you can find a leading expert in whatever industry to say whatever you like. Dr. Wecht is a special kind of forensic pathologist, though, in that he also had a law degree. When Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey was published, he had performed 13,000 autopsies and consulted on 30,000 more. So it's safe to say he's incredibly experienced and chuck in the law degree. He can look at this from multiple angles, so he's a good witness or a good expert, you could say. The autopsy was released 8 days after JonBenet died, and it concluded that JonBenet died from asphyxia from strangulation from the garrote around her neck. She had also sustained a serious blow to the head, and this was clear from an 8-inch crack in her skull. The base of this break was almost perfectly rectangular and smooth, like she had been hit with a heavy object that had a larger top than bottom, and smooth edges, like a golf club, or a flashlight. Her temporal lobe also showed damage consistent with shaking, The CBS documentary claims that the break in JonBenet's skull was an exact fit for the black flashlight that had been visible on the kitchen counter in the crime scene video footage. They even do this very, like, macabre little, like, experiment where they get a kid about Burke's age at the time, so 9 years old, to hit a skull with a flashlight. And they find that the same kind of skull-splitting damage could be done. But the problem is that when the police returned to try and collect the flashlight as evidence, they couldn't find it. So I'm not exactly sure how the CBS crack team could have possibly known the exact flashlight measurements.
The CBS team say that the torch was, quote, not claimed by either police nor the Ramseys. But I've also read in other places that it was not found at all and it just totally disappeared. I do not know who to believe on that. But if you watch the CBS documentary, the way they talk about the flashlight is so vague. Watch it again with that in your mind that actually they never found it and it disappeared, and you will be a bit more suspicious of it, I think. However, it's completely possible that the source who says the flashlight completely disappeared is not telling the truth either. Like, it's a complete den of fucking lies.
You can say we know that the torch existed at one point because it's in the video footage from the crime scene. And maybe they could get the measurements from the video footage, like a good enough guess, and the shape could be seen and it could be matched that way to the skull cracking.
I mean, possibly, but you can't call that an exact match.
Yeah. And again, the fact that the torch did go missing, is it a coincidence? It just got moved around in the chaos, or did it get disposed of? Like, we just don't know. When was the video footage taken? We know that fucking John Ramsey was allowed out of the house. Did he take it, dispose of it?
They had days to dispose of it because the police didn't come back for it for ages.
That too.
It wouldn't have even had to have been that morning. So I think this is the thing, I mean, we've been struggling with most of all, but I think what it comes down to is this. Where you stand on what happened to JonBenet Ramsey really depends on whether you think it was the blow to the head or the asphyxiation that killed her. CBS want you to believe that she was struck on the head and then strangled a little bit to make it look like a kidnapping, but crucially, it was the blunt trauma to her head that finished her off. Dr. Wecht disagrees. What CBS don't tell you is there's actually a lot of evidence to suggest that JonBenet was sexually assaulted. CBS deny this totally. They just skip right over it. But here is the evidence as it was laid out in her autopsy. So there was an abrasion inside of JonBenet's vagina, and her hymen contained what they call epithelial erosion with underlying capillary congestion. And that is, it's irritation. It's a sign that something has gone on there. Her vaginal walls showed signs of chronic inflammation. And we're talking about inflammation that was 48 to 72 hours old. Whatever caused it happened before Christmas Day. Foreign material was also found in JonBenet's genital area. There were numerous traces of dark fiber and particles of something like talcum powder. All of these things seem to point towards some kind of penetration. And where do you find talcum powder? You find it on latex gloves. So is it possible that someone had digitally penetrated JonBenet wearing a medical glove? Or is it a little bit more innocent than that? JonBenet's pediatrician reported that he had never suspected that JonBenet was being subjected to any form of abuse, sexual or otherwise. JonBenet had suffered from occasional discomfort while urinating and vaginitis. And these can be caused by loads of things. A reaction to bubble bath, for example. I just don't think it's impossible that JonBenet couldn't have inflicted the vaginal abrasion on herself if she was uncomfortable. It's possible. Kids do shit like that all the time.
And we do know also, like, she was in all these beauty pageants. Like, maybe Patsy was just, like, spraying her with loads of perfume, loads of bubble bath.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got an irritation and she's, like, scratched herself. Like, God, it's uncomfortable. Vaginitis isn't great. So
no,
she's a 6-year-old kid. Like, she has a scratch. Like, maybe it was that.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
If you're itchy, you're going to scratch it. There was also some blood found in JonBenet's vagina, but again, that could be down to all sorts of things. There was no bruising or tearing in the genital area. So if sexual abuse was happening, penile penetration looks pretty unlikely. Obviously, that's not the only form of abuse, but that's what the evidence suggests.
Of course, it's not the only sign of abuse, but if they're making a case for sexual abuse, like, there is evidence that there was something, but not necessarily clear-cut. She was being sexually abused. But it is weird that CBS are just like, nah.
And I also think, like, it comes from the strangulation thing being associated with autoerotic asphyxiation. I think if you think that the strangling of her was a sexual thing,
all of the other sort of symptoms of sexual abuse seem a lot more significant. But if it wasn't that, you could probably explain them with, you know, bubble bath.
Exactly, because the strangulation could have been, as you said, sort of autoerotic asphyxiation, or it could have just been strangulation and a coincidence that it happened to be the type that it was, which we'll talk about now. But before we do that, let's come back quickly to the question of the talcum powder. Jean-Benet's bladder, when she died, was empty. Was it possible that she had wet the bed and that the talcum powder had been administered by John or Patsy in some sort of cleanup effort? Maybe, like when you wet yourself, even if she's been washed, you know, she's got some sort of vaginitis, like maybe some talc to, you know, stop some chafing or something. I don't know. I don't have kids, but you put them on babies, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. You put talc on kids all the time. Yeah,
exactly. So had the vaginal abrasion been a result of something like vigorous wiping by a tired and or irritated parent? We don't know. There was also pineapple found in Jean-Benet's digestive system, and it was estimated that she had probably consumed it about 2 hours prior to her death. Dr. Cyril Wecht poses the following theory, assuming that Jean-Benet was being sexually abused. He says that she was strangled by her abuser in an attempt to induce autoerotic asphyxiation, and that the intent had never been to kill her. He assumed this because there was almost no damage to Jean-Benet's neck. The strap muscles on either side of her neck were undamaged, so no great force at all had been used. But he also hypothesized that the garrote fashioned from the white cord and Patsy's broken paintbrush accidentally pinched Jean-Benet's vagus nerve. And that's the nerve that runs from the brain down the neck. The vagus nerve is in charge of regulating major organs, especially the heart and lungs. When messages from the vagus nerve are therefore interrupted, the body enters what is called electrical death, and breathing can stop. Jean-Benet's eyes exhibited hemorrhaging, indicating that she had still been breathing and her heart had still been pumping blood as she was being strangled. Wecht argues that Jean-Benet was already circling the drain, so to speak, when she suffered the head injury, because the subdural hemorrhage was recorded as containing only 7 or 8 centimeters of blood. That's less than 2 teaspoons. If she was not already almost dead from the trapping of her vagus nerve, there should have been a lot more bleeding than this from that head injury. And this stage is called perimortem. Jean-Benet's brain was also swollen. It was 15% heavier than it should have been. Wecht uses this as further evidence to support his theory that her brain was starved of oxygen before the blow had cracked her skull. If the head injury was the thing that had killed her, Jean-Benet's brain would not have had time to swell that much.
So you do have to ask, if the abuser was strangling Jean-Benet with no intention of killing her, why is the head wound inflicted when she looked like she was already dead? Dr. Wecht argues that perhaps someone had been trying to protect Jean-Benet and the blunt object blow had been meant for the perpetrator but had accidentally landed on the victim. It's complicated because obviously Dr. Wecht is, you know, this incredibly experienced guy, but then so is the autopsy man that they have in the CBS documentary, and he says basically the opposite thing. So it's so difficult to know. Jean-Benet's body also exhibited abrasions to her right cheek, her right shoulder, and behind her right ear. Wecht argues that these happened as she was squirming against the wall or the floor during her sexual abuse. There were also 2 marks found on Jean-Benet's body that some claim are consistent with those left by a stun gun. The CBS documentary claimed that they are actually from a toy train track that Jean-Benet had been poked with after she died. How hard do you have to poke someone with a piece of toy train track to leave a mark? Fucking hard, I think.
Yeah. Hard enough that the mark could be confused with that from a stun gun. You're giving him a proper jab with that.
I'm not even sure I would be able to inflict that much force with it, because it's not it's an awkward thing to be holding.
It is.
Not
it
that is. I'm going to go and start battering people with train track now just to find out, but like, well, also the thing that they do in the CBS documentary that I thought was a bit suspect. So she has 2 sort of what look like punctures. The bit of train track they show, so they're arguing that it's like the connecty bits of the train track that have poked her. The bit that they show has 3 prongs. And they don't show it for very long, but it like it has 3 connecty bits. And I'm just a bit like, that kind of.
I know. I think, I guess we were talking about this yesterday. And what I would say about the CBS documentary is, like most true crime documentaries, yes, absolutely. We all watch them. They're all there. But bear in mind that nobody really likes telling a story that's just like, well, we don't really know what happened. Here's some things that happened here. Here's some things that happened here. Off you go. These things are usually built with some form of agenda attached to them. And really what they're doing is what we see in court. What a good prosecution would do is build a narrative using the evidence that points towards a presupposed theory. They had this theory, which we'll talk about, and I'm not saying it's wrong at all. But they leave out the information that doesn't fit it, and they build a really strong case around the stuff that does. That's what they're doing. And it's very compelling, don't get me wrong. The first time I watched it, I was like, fuck, that's it. But let's leave the autopsy for a while now and have a look at the infamous ransom note that Patsy claims to have found on the stairs. And here it is in full. Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully, ! We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business, but not the country it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed. If you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money, and hence an earlier delivery, crossed out, pickup of your daughter. Any deviations of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you do not provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John! Signed off, Victory! SBTC.
Pretty long-winded for a ransom note, isn't it?
Just a bit. It's very, theatrical, overly descriptive, I would say. A C-.
And that's not the only thing that's strange about it. Obviously, you've just heard it, but when you see it written down, quite a lot of other things become apparent. The pen and paper on which the note was written with and on came from Patsy's notepad that she kept by the phone. Both pad and pen were found in the same places that they always were. The pad also exhibited two practice notes. One of them, so it's not like she just left them there, but it was in the indentation.
Yeah.
So of ripped out pages. And one of them had, so that one obviously starts Mr. Ramsey. The one that had been written and just didn't make the cut said Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey. So whoever wrote it, it was Patsy, takes Patsy out of the situation.
It's very weird to write a very weird ransom note, but even weirder maybe to write one to yourself. So she's like, I'll take myself out of this situation. And I just love that you know it was her. You know it was the mum because she puts the notepad and paper back in the place that they're meant to be.
Exactly.
No one else does that.
If we believe that someone broke into their house and left this note, we have to believe that one, they knew where to find the pen and paper. Two, they were kind enough to put it back when they were finished. And three, they had time to write three pages and two false starts, all while the remaining Ramseys were all asleep upstairs. If a small foreign faction were planning the kidnap of a kid, why would they not bring their own ransom note? They just got there and they're like, oh, shit, I forgot. Fuck.
Especially one that is so descriptive. They're just like, it's fine. We've got this six-year-old that we've kidnapped and her whole family is asleep upstairs. We're just going to chill out here while I write this note. And what is this person just like? you know I've always wanted to be a writer. Just let me have this. You said that if I came along that you would let me write the ransom note. You stop interrupting me. We've already fucked it up twice.
What is happening?
The note borrows extremely heavily from similar ransom situations in the films Dirty Harry, Ransom, and Speed. John Ramsay was a very wealthy man. Why would they ask for 118,000 when they could have had millions? Is it worth noting that 118,000 was almost the exact amount that John Ramsay had received as a bonus from his company that year? I find this hilarious. Why would a foreign terrorist organization not say who they were? And why would they give a shit about a graphics company, let alone respect their work? And also, why would a foreign terrorist organization care about Southern common sense? Like, I think the only people who say things like that are people from the South.
Oh, absolutely. And just the weirdness of, like, almost the stroking John's ego almost while they're saying all this derogatory stuff, like saying, like, we respect your business. You're not the only fact. Like, what? It's like, why are you saying that when you've kidnapped his fucking daughter? Just get to the point. Very strange, very strange. The ransom note also displays pretty basic spelling mistakes. For example, there are too many S's in business. That's a pretty like strange mistake. Especially when you consider that more complicated words like countermeasure are spelled correctly. And all the mistakes appear in the first paragraph, almost as if the person who wrote it was trying to make it look as if the person who wrote the note was not a native English speaker and then forgot to keep up the mistakes. So yeah, the misspellings of like business happen in the first bit and then whoever's writing it forgets to misspell or remembers how to correctly spell business later on while they're writing this massive ransom note. The notepad also showed 7 sets of prints. One belonged to a police sergeant. Why are you picking up notepads without your... Where are your gloves? Where are your gloves? And one to a forensic examiner. Again, where are your gloves? And all other 5 prints belonged to Patsy Ramsay. More forensic handwriting experts have looked at that note than you can shake a stick at. And like everything else in this case, it is so hard to know who to believe. The handwriting experts that the Ramsay hired say that there is no way that either of the Ramsays wrote the note. I wonder why they say that. Others ruled out John, but not Patsy. Others say that it was definitely Patsy, just using her left hand.
And we've seen examples of Patsy's writing, and I do have to say that it does look incredibly similar to the handwriting in the ransom note. But having said that, she does have pretty bait handwriting. There's nothing particularly special about it. For example, your handwriting and my sister's handwriting are identical.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Whereas my handwriting, because I like learn to write in like a really ridiculous way, is very distinctive. I just think that the way Patsy writes, I'm like, I probably know about 7 people who I would mistake that handwriting for.
Yeah, I think the handwriting analysis is like, it's an interesting thing, but like you said, everybody says something different. To me, more what sticks out is just the weird note itself more than and the fact of like it having been written in the house that sets off alarm bells.
And in one of the documentaries that we've listed below, Patsy's interviewed about her handwriting and asked to compare it to the ransom note. And so she's given like words or like letters and it's in her handwriting and then it's the one that's on the ransom note. And she is so evasive when she's asked to point out the similarities between these letters and she's like, they're both G's. Like she just like will not give an inch on it. It's really quite astonishing to watch. She just refuses to say that there are any similarities at all between the letters when they are the same. And they're like, Patsy, did these look the same to you? And she's like, no. And I was like, are you... Yes, yes, they are. So whatever happened to JonBenet, I don't know who did it, but I am certain that Patsy Ramsay wrote that ransom note. And that's something that most sources who weren't hired by the Ramsay family tend to agree with.
Now we have to deal with the issue of the pineapple in JonBenet's stomach. As we said earlier, it was not fully digested. So it means that she ate it sometime in the night before she died. Even though, according to her parents, she was sound asleep. Police called to the crime scene reported that there was a bowl of pineapple and milk next to a glass of tea on a table in the house. The bowl and glass displayed Patsy's fingerprints and Burke's fingerprints. Based on this, the CBS team hypothesized that Burke was given this food by his mother and JonBenet came down the stairs and nicked a bit with her bare hands, and that this made Burke so angry that he hit her on the head with the flashlight, accidentally killing her, and then Patsy and John Ramsay covered up the whole thing and staged the kidnapping. which is a great theory. If you ignore certain things, like, for example, the bits of evidence that do suggest that there may have been sexual abuse, doesn't necessarily mean that that makes that theory impossible. But it is interesting that CBS completely disregard it. But I guess it's because, like we said, if you were building a case against this and that was your narrative, this would lead people on a side path that they don't want you to go down. There is video footage of an 11-year-old Burke. And this is a big bit of the case that the CBS documentary used, because there is video footage of an 11-year-old Burke being questioned about the pineapple. And he doesn't right away say what it is. But we've seen the picture and...
No, I wouldn't know what that was. Like, I think, like, they're like, show him the photograph and they're like, what's that? And he's like, a bowl? But it's not cereal, is it? And then they sort of lead him to it. And you could take that two ways. But like, also, the photograph just isn't that clear. Like, it looks like lumps of like matter.
I will agree that it's not 100% clear. But what I would say is when you watch him being interviewed, I think it's like by a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they're showing him all of these different photos. He seems very like comfortable. And again, this may have just been the way that CBS edited it and cut this footage together. But it seems like he's very like happy and comfortable and answering, oh, that's this, that's this, that's this. Then when it gets to the pineapple, his body language seems to change. And then he's like, he doesn't even say he doesn't know. He says he doesn't know for ages, and he seems very on edge. My only thing is, if he had been behaving like that the entire interview, okay. But because his behavior changes, and also we could be like, it's not that clear. It is his bowl and his pineapple. If you showed me a blurry picture of something I own, I'd probably still be able to tell you what it was. But again, you could honestly take this in either direction.
Yeah.
I could argue both sides all day long. So it doesn't help. And also you could say he could just be uncomfortable because he's a kid on his own in a room with a stranger, just questioning him constantly.
CBS also claimed that the DNA evidence found on JonBenet's body, specifically in her underwear, was of no forensic value. And I think I agree with them there. JonBenet's body was moved around so much that she could have picked up literally anything. But I just don't think we can totally rule out sexual abuse. Burke Ramsey is now a grown-up, and he recently settled a $750 million defamation lawsuit against CBS. His lawyers argued that the accusations of murder against Burke Ramsey were based on, quote, a compilation of lies, half-truths, manufactured information, and the intentional omission and avoidance of truthful information about the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. And I have to say, I think there's some truth in there, even on the 911 call alone, which is what they build their whole case around. I just don't hear what they're hearing. Like, they're just like, this is what it is.
The 911 call, I disagree with. I don't think that would be like an impactful piece of evidence for me, because I really don't hear what they're saying. I don't think you can tell tone, and I don't think you can distinctively hear three voices. At least I personally can't. I don't think you can rule out sexual abuse, but to me, I don't feel like there's enough evidence of it that it would make me feel like there was definitely abuse going on.
And we're certainly not trying to catch a lawsuit here, but that's not really to say that Burke couldn't have been responsible for JonBenet's murder. If we accept the autoerotic asphyxiation / sexual abuse argument, which we might not, but let's pretend for a second that we are, it could have been him. He slept in JonBenet's room sometimes, and we have no idea of knowing how innocent that was. And maybe the whole thing was just a game gone wrong. Maybe a parent rushed in, saw the strangulation, and the blow to the head was meant for Burke. Or maybe it was an intruder. But the problem we've got with that argument is the lack of DNA evidence, no signs of forced entry, and the fact that every piece of evidence connected with this case was already inside the Ramsey house and all of the doors were locked all night. So what it comes down to is which expert you believe and whether you think the head injury or the asphyxiation was the thing that killed JonBenet.
In 1999, the case was put before a grand jury, and this grand jury voted to indict both Patsy and John Ramsey on child endangerment and the obstruction of a murder investigation. And this is very important because the grand jury did not move to indict them on murder charges, no matter what the CBS documentary may imply and have led you to believe. But it doesn't matter either way, because the prosecutor felt that there was not enough evidence to support either of these indictments beyond a reasonable doubt. So nothing happened. The Ramseys were never prosecuted for the murder of JonBenet or for any connected charges. They were never even formally named as suspects in the murder investigation. In 2008, they were actually cleared entirely by the Boulder District Attorney's Office. And by they, we mean all three Ramseys. They were announced completely cleared, and the DA's office even apologized for their treatment over the years. This absolution was allegedly given on the basis of new DNA evidence. But what evidence that was, I have no idea. Surely their DNA was all over the place. It was their house. And we have read in some places that this evidence was a new found DNA profile that was found in the house that matched blood on JonBenet's clothing. How are you ruling people out just because even if you have found a new DNA profile, that could have literally come from anywhere. But they do, apparently. And also given the fact that she was moved around so much, like we said, it's hard to know where this could have come from. But this clearance sadly came a bit too late for Patsy Ramsey, who died of ovarian cancer in 2006 at the age of 49.
But it is so far from being over. In 2010, the case was officially reopened. Further testing of DNA samples has been conducted, but no real conclusions have been made. But that hasn't stopped people confessing to the crime. People who lean towards the sexual abuse argument often cite JonBenet's pageant participation as being overly sexualized. And that might be true. So some claim that JonBenet would have been a prime target for paedophiles. There are a lot of pictures of her everywhere. Gary Oliva was a registered sex offender who was in Boulder the night of JonBenet's murder, and he confessed to killing JonBenet accidentally. He wrote his confession in a letter to a friend while he was serving 10 years in prison for possession of child pornography. He told his pen pal, quote, "I never loved anyone like I did JonBenet. And yet I let her slip and her head bashed in half and I watched her die. It was an accident. Please believe me. She's not like the other kids." And then the pen pal claimed to have received a distressed phone call from Oliva that fateful Boxing Day in 1996. And apparently he told her through sobs that he had, quote, "hurt a little girl." The Boulder Police Department became totally disinterested in Gary's confession when they couldn't find any of his DNA at the scene.
Are you stumped? Well, so are we. And we've been staring at this fucking rabbit Warren case all week. And before we let you know our final thoughts on this true crime treasure trove, we've picked out the greatest hits of the internet sleuth theories. Bill McReynolds was hired by the Ramseys to play Father Christmas at the Ramseys' Christmas party 3 nights before JonBenet was killed. And he gave her a card that said, "You will receive a very special gift after Christmas." 22 years before, his own daughter had gone missing on Christmas Day. Now, tempting as that one is, McReynolds was cleared by DNA testing and died in 2002. A liberal activist group called the Asia-Pacific American Coalition were also kicking around Colorado University in 1996, and some have speculated that the ransom note was put down to them and that the $118,000 that they demanded was actually JonBenet's time of death. This group disbanded shortly after that Christmas.
This wouldn't be a conspiracy theory roundup without some aliens. So some people think that the foreign faction part of the ransom note was actually code for extraterrestrial beings who were so jealous of JonBenet's beauty that they killed her. And as you'll remember, there were no footprints in the snow because aliens float and don't need to use our stupid doors and windows to get in places. Another conspiracy theory classic from the 9/11 was an inside job collection is this one. And it says that John Ramsey was targeted by the Canadian Air Force because he refused to help in the orchestration of the destruction of the Twin Towers and Building 7. And last but not least, this is my personal favourite. Some claim that JonBenet never really died at all, and the whole thing was an elaborate hoax so that she could eventually reemerge as chart-topping pop princess Katy Perry.
Because nothing means anything anymore.
Yeah, they even say that Patsy looks the same as Katy Perry's mum. And like all of the, and like if you look at a picture of Katy Perry and you look at a picture of JonBenet, they do look pretty similar. Their eyebrows are like basically the same. I highly doubt it.
But I think it's like the extent of you saying that your sisters and my handwriting look the same. Like,
yeah.
Just two white girls who could look like they were the same. I don't know. I just like, I do know. Of all the things I know, I don't think that Katy Perry is JonBenet Ramsey. Right, okay. Fun time over, down to crunch time. What do we think really happened to JonBenet Ramsey? I do think that her death was an accident.
I agree.
But whether it was part of a sex game or maybe a more innocent game even between brother and sister, I don't know. Maybe she was being abused by one of her parents. And if we accept that it was the garrote that had killed her rather than the accidental bludgeoning because of the pineapple stealing, then the strangling kind of cover-up thing is out of the question. If we believe Dr. Weck's brain inflammation argument, then the strangulation is key.
It makes more logical sense that you're like, oh, she accidentally gets whacked on her head with this torch and then they strangle her a bit to make it look like an accident. That seems to make more logical sense. But that becomes problematic if you believe what Dr. Weck's analysis of her brain was, and if it was the strangling that killed her, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
It is. And I also think I had a problem. My biggest hole or my biggest issue with the whole CBS theory was I can buy that Bert got angry and smacked her over the head. The number of times my brother and I punched each other in the head, I'm surprised one of us isn't dead. But what sort of parents, and I don't think this is the type of parents that John and Patsy necessarily were, could just be like, oh, okay, well, we just better go rot her a bit. That's bizarre to me. That doesn't fit at all. I personally think it is the pineapple thing, that she comes down, steals a piece of pineapple, puts it in her mouth. JonBenet and Burke have a tumultuous relationship leading up to this anyway. He gets pissed off and he garrots her because he's made a little garrot with white cord and like a paint, his mum's paintbrush. And I think he probably already had it because maybe he was just a weird kid. He grabs her, he starts choking her. I quite like the theory that one of the parents walked in on it, because Patsy sounds like she was still awake because she's in the same clothes she was in the night before. She comes down, hears the chaos, tries to get her son off JonBenet, whacks him with a torch, or tries to, and ends up hitting JonBenet, and that's what finishes it off. Maybe.
I kind of like that one because, like, what you were saying yesterday about, you know, if it was John Ramsay who'd killed her, I don't think Patsy would cover for him. But I think she would cover for herself and her son.
I agree. Thank you for bringing that up. I do think that's a very important point, is that would a mother cover up this hard to cover up her husband's potential abuse and murder of their young daughter? A daughter that she seemingly absolutely adored? I don't think so. Like, but would you do it for your kid? More likely. And I also do think that allegations of, like, Burke not necessarily liking JonBenet does seem like they spent a lot more time and effort on JonBenet. A lot of her pageantry time took up a lot of the time. And also, the name even. JonBenet was named after her dad. Her dad's middle name is Bennett. John Bennett Ramsay, JonBenet Ramsay. Like, come on. I just think Burke felt like ostracized. He was a bit of a weird kid. He fucking choked her. Maybe. Please don't sue us.
Can we tell the Americans what Burke means in rhyming slang?
What Burke means in rhyming slang?
Mm-hmm.
You do it. Go for it.
It means the C word.
It's an unfortunate name. And maybe he came across that and he was like, you named me Burke and you named her after yourself. This is outrageous. I'm going to garrot her. Maybe. That's what happened.
Please don't sue us.
We'll just keep saying maybe.
Maybe. Maybe. Allegedly, possibly, but almost definitely not. I think one of the members of the family was responsible for her death. And the cover-up was certainly orchestrated from inside the house. And what reason would they have for protecting anyone but themselves? The only thing I've come away with this week feeling very strongly about is be careful what you watch in documentaries. They often have big budgets and points to prove.
Exactly. And also, no one is ever pointing a finger at them in the first instance. The police are like treating them like they are not at all even suspects, but they like fucking go full force into defense. Why? You're right. They're protecting themselves and they wouldn't protect anybody else that hard.
So that's it. That's JonBenet Ramsay. Merry Christmas. Don't take any shit. Challenge things. Look out for floating aliens. Have a lovely time off and we will see you in 2020.
I think that should just be our generic motto for our listeners.
Don't take shit. Look out for aliens.
Challenge things and look out for floating aliens. Merry Christmas.
And
whatever
Merry
time
Christmas.
Of year. May the Christmas spirit stay with you all year. But anyway, that is that. That is also the end of 2019 at Red Handed. Apart from the $5 up patron Car Chronicle episodes that will be going out very soon. So go enjoy that. Other than that, here are some people who are already some lovely patrons that we have to thank. Oh my God, there are so many of you.
Yeah, sorry, I got really carried away.
Thank you so much. Ashley, Diane, Amy Birch, Tessa Foster, Caitlin, John Wang, Joe Pex, Karina Ross, Sarah Major, Raina Deaton, Kaylia Coolwhip, Chris Marshall, Olivia de Flocker, Nancy Lackey, Abby, Caitlin Superintendent, I don't know. Jen Beamont, Megan Bailey, Britt, Mindy from Chicago, first stop on your worldwide tour.
We're trying, Mindy.
We're trying. God knows we're trying.
Hayley Burrows, Kaylee McBrenner, Maya Holcomb, Ryan Brazil, Lindsay Wilson, and Angelia Arcala, Maya, Ashley Klorn, Heather Whitaker, Kit, and then Hannah.
Joanna Crawford, Chant, Emma Seabrook, Victoria Nerim, Susan Hadley, Anna DePilicki, Laurel Codgell, Sebastian, oh, Jesus God, Sebastian. Sebastian Hegel Marson Clark, Nina Lindsay, Catherine Pine, Katie Reed, Jane Baston, Danielle Robichaud, Angela Higgins, Aridana, Solis, Elena Clock, Fiona S. Hall, Katie O'Connor, Jessica Stewart, BW, Anna Robertson, Elizabeth Whitworth, Sarah Ford, Cindy Rahi, I don't know, Cindy, I'm sorry. Valerie, I can feel my brain slowing down.
Yeah, I know.
Valerie Pinardin, Catherine Hunter, Gloria Azucena, Candice E, Chloe Boyce, Kells, Brianne Koch, Taylor Munich, Mary Eaton, Laura Compton, Katie Ann Chapelanik, Camille, Jasmine Warazeski, Katie Sproul, Shawnee Prether, Summer Lee Riley, Holly Bowler, Anne Gonzalez, Matilda Silen, Katie Finley, Crystal Eglahanian, Anna Forsyth. I'm just going to start saying bullshit, not real words with confidence.
I also realised I tagged out way sooner than I should have.
It's fine. So Sarah Dyer, Rachel Height, Melissa Sunnunnun, but that's not real. Jana Lucas, Georgina Middleton, Stephanie Helliott, Sadie Joe, Sam Rickards, Melissa Gerhardt, Alyssa, Michaela, Kristen Lewiski, So Devilish, Alison Tyler, Janelle Braswell, Sabina, Laura Hedges, Felicia White, Rosie Court, Rebecca Andrews, Lisa McKay, Megan, and June Redding.
Well done, she got the Megan. And if you're wondering why you maybe hear your name again, or if you're thinking, why am I hearing that name again? It's because if you do edit upwards, if you do upgrade yourself as a patron, you will get another thank you from us.
Because we're that nice.
We are that nice. And also, I don't know how to remove them from the list. So there you go. Thank you guys so much. What a fucking great 2019. Here's to an amazing 2020. We can't wait.
See you in a brand new year with the same old us.
Oh, yes. See you then. Bye.
Bye.